당이 대들 납나 맞대서 세면에 갈래를 세본 그래 저런 걸 라브란디 하고서
근데 뭐라 라고
다다 뭐뭐 맞춘이 실고나 요사래데 개버면 되고 라고 미 라브나스 가르 고가 말았지
라라라
내가 거기서 갈래를 세본 그래
라서
다가 인양 아주 대지 냠랭 거로 간데 추 냠슬랭 거지 아주 뒤톡니 되는 가자라고 요래 드니 익셔던거 맞아 리당워비 추냠슬랭비 두소 당급 죽님 죽바르트 드니 셈바잔드 마야니 셈라 여콤 쇼크슴라 타바다 타그낭 말씀젠라 드니 냥르제당 샴발라 소바 제거는 백커 보용 거래 그러지는 마서 리통어 바래 아주 치츠 지긴 난다 그다 두서 런통 가세 냠슬레나 디 콜롱고니 좀 주고르트 콜롱이 뭐 저용야 까모레 아주 남독세야드 페 마차비 Mambo Masozolan Toya Yora Tate Yore de Yinaya Tungpo Ma Rang Salan Dugni Maso Kuchin Tang Laka Dang Tolan Dugpi Tuzu Tani Tets Tate Lamsung Lamsung Dombagan Gomuzoni Karma Chigni La Samlotoni Koran Chigbu Nyamzalena Anga karesin in dandu ni chunyam sulem bare tani chinyik nik tsum ni koran so ta pa jaga tenda nik tsum na o map tsum na karesin na chik sam lo ji tani ma karesin ni ngandu wa da yore karesin ni mi ta ta shego ge jim sen ta so sam lo ta tani chik kon lung jik ten chuk jet ta kon lung amba ge Somebody on the so lumps on Chuni or Tangan Chuksons, mean Norsons. The Zukwis Honji Chumden Diki on Tender Somandu. Matsu Tsavi Lama Tamcheki on Tender Somandu. Matsu Takwa Chembu, Chunyam Selembi, Chimdorji Kangan on Tender Somandu, Tanga Chusore. He called no Yako Chugur or something, Semjan Tamchet. Japani, Madame Narmekover. Rituk semjen tamchetini dungar yimba. So so rituk sesala dungar ereola. Tapar na saftawe na sa chimbortumi dungar zia. Samayam tatsut ka dungar. Tini mela, kerga, nanchi dungar. Tandola, lunjan, mumbi dungar. Yetakla, tijan, kumbi dungar. Tos of samji machabayore. Ta yenayanga switchik. Matang, chik tandro. Tenda kerik laka niskap ko devan chamo samiror da tsongo ne niskap re chumbar ki nimar ta bo namon tem ni chumba ma mo tbiyo na ten ni chumba sha te sindo ni ti paror ni nima te sanga tu tala ga nima tsawa ji yongra ta nga tsu niskap ko deva te ta wa se tem yo mar ma tsu ta kare ze cherep thogma ke dungar la samlo ta na ma tsu deva tenda ke deva yin thong thong ji re तत्सो सेमजेन थामचे लंगा सोखचिक बो माइम बे रुटु के सेमजेन थामचे योरे तत्सो चोपी छे त तेला फंतो बि छे त नंद नंदु गनिनी तत छ छ त्रा फों का छे जो कने ती तोन दर सामनी न्यार जे ता त नि यर कुम छ सम ला ता पा दा मार सेमजेन थामचे ल न्यार जे ग गोनी नि दों बा तिन गोबसों छिक सम बा नाम तक सम ला छि होत छ गो पा हो पो छि मा Then the Labunduga, Lur Dang Tolayo, Luganala Semyo, Semganala Loyo Pajigore. The Lur Dangatana, Sem Shirer Namto Kayani, Chirdorinum, Chirsorinum, we want the Vesona, then Lur Dang Tolayona, Pantormea, Sem Shirer Layan de Gore. Tene sem nala yo na yang sem cho yang sem cho good cho good zia te nam to go po da nam to cho di mambo tenda yin na sha da pan to koma sem la so yo ba shi tene sem la so yo bi kap se tene sem che te chuni tene kum chok sem la ya chi ta pa ta ta na sem jen la nyang ji kum ni ko nu chuni tene ta rang rang ke chu chok na ni nyam len shin nan da rang rang ke Chokan on in Yamlin Shinanda, Kong in Jang. Tao, then I should you pay me a cash for it.
As Rinpoche began speaking, he said, "It's fine if people continue to come in and sit down while I'm talking. You don't understand my words anyway, right?" So, what we're talking about today is how do we actually practice the Dharma? Generally, we are beginners when it comes to practice. And as beginners, to practice from beginning to end of the practice without the mind being distracted, holding the three jewels with perfect faith and pure vision, holding sentient beings with perfect loving kindness and compassion, that's very difficult because we're beginners. To practice for an hour or however long our practice is going to be, and from the moment of generating the proper motivation at the beginning of the practice all the way through to the end, to follow the practice through without distraction and holding the practice perfectly, that's extremely difficult. Because we're beginners, and we have many, many concepts always arising in our minds. But what we can do is to try to take care and be mindful or heedful from the first moment that we sit down on our cushion to practice. We don't need to immediately begin the recitation, whatever we are going to recite, if we are going to recite something. You can take a minute or two when you first sit down and consider, what am I doing here? You can take a moment to bring forth faith. You can close your eyes or not, whatever the case may be, but to really bring forth faith and really consider, why am I sitting here? Why did I sit down on this cushion? Why am I going to practice? And really examine your motivation. And if your motivation is still just caught up in the eight worldly concerns, then recognize my motivation is incorrect and immediately correct it. Immediately make your motivation pure. Make your motivation correct. If you see that you have an incorrect motivation, then modify it, change it. We are there. We are there alone, practicing, sitting in our practice place. And we have to check ourselves if our motivation is good or not. We have to check ourselves and see if we are in alignment with what the gurus have said, if we are in alignment with the Mahayana Dharma, if we are in alignment with the teachings that we have received or not. And only we can check ourselves, only we can check our own minds and know ourselves. And we should also take this moment to generate compassion and bodhicitta for all other beings in a very genuine way. We should consider from the pinnacle of existence, from the highest experiences possible in samsara, down to the intolerable sufferings of the lowest hell realms, all sentient beings throughout the whole spectrum of the six realms of existence, all sentient beings are suffering, and each suffer in their own ways, but they are all suffering. The gods, they suffer their particular sufferings of falling and so forth. The jealous gods, the demigods, they suffer from constant strife and conflict. As humans, we suffer from birth, aging, sickness, and death. Animals suffer from stupidity and so forth. The hungry spirits suffer from extreme hunger and thirst, deprivation of every kind. And the hell beings suffer as well. Beings suffer in inconceivable ways. And among the various realms, you might think, oh, if you're in the human realm or maybe the animal realm, you have some little happiness. You're not suffering so much. And that's true. There is some happiness there. But that happiness is so temporary. That happiness is just adventitious, completely dependent on circumstances. Just a little moment of happiness. That's all that we get, even in the best case scenario, even in the best possible circumstances in samsara. We just get brief instants, little glimpses of happiness. It's like when the clouds completely cover the sky, when the sun is completely obscured by thick, heavy clouds, and then there's just a little break in the clouds, and the sun shines through just for a moment. And for a moment, you get the heat and light of the sun, and then it goes away again. This temporary happiness of the higher realms is no more than that. And mostly throughout all of our lifetimes, from beginningless time until now, we have not been in those brief moments of sunshine. We have not had any happiness, even temporary happiness. In general, we have always been suffering. And in general, we have always been creating the causes of further suffering, which is why our happiness, when it comes, brief as it is so short. This isn't just our own individual predicament. This is the plight of all sentient beings throughout the six realms. And recognizing that they all share the same depth of suffering that you yourself experience and have experienced, then you will be filled with the wish to bring them benefit. And when that thought arises sincerely in your mind, I wish I could do something for them. I wish I could benefit them. That is a genuine thought of compassion, a genuine thought of loving kindness, a genuine thought of altruism. And that should be the reason that you sit down on the cushion to practice for however long it is. Is this a genuine compassion for sentient beings? This perfectly pure motivation, this perfectly pure altruism, this wish to bring benefits to others. The mind should be filled with the correct motivation, so the mind should be correctly oriented. And it also should be very much at ease. It is said that the body should be straight, the mind should be within the body, and there should be ease within the mind. The body should be straight means you sit properly with the spine straight. That the mind should be within the body means that your mind shouldn't be outside everywhere while your body is sitting on the cushion. Or else the body sitting on the cushion is not going to do you any good. When you sit down to practice, you need to sit the body down, and then you need to sit the mind down in the body so that the mind is actually going to sit and stay just as the body is going to. Then the meditation will be of some benefit. And to say that there should be ease within the mind means not only do you need to keep your mind in your body, but you need for the mind to be at ease, to be at rest. If the mind is filled with excitation and quite wild, there is also not going to be any benefit. The mind will not be able to settle and engage in the practice. So the body needs to be straight, the mind needs to be in the body, and the mind needs to be at ease, or there needs to be ease in the mind. Then, with that, you can give rise to faith in the three jewels. You can give rise to compassion for sentient beings. And you can examine your motivation. And if your motivation is not pure, you can change it. You can adjust it so that your motivation is pure. Whether you are practicing in a group practice, if you come to the temple or the Dharma Center, or whether you're practicing by yourself at home, in either case, this is extremely important. Then you do your practice for however long it is that you are going to practice, maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours, whatever the length of practice might be. Then you do your practice, having adjusted and corrected your motivation. And it doesn't matter which practice you are doing. I don't mean that the differences in practice aren't important. It just means no matter what you are practicing, this process is the same. You have to examine your own mind. You have to adjust your own motivation. Maybe most of you are practicing the Ngundro, the preliminary practices. Maybe some are doing Yidam practice, deity practice. Maybe some are meditating by resting in samadhi. Maybe some are meditating on the view of Dzogchen Tempo. Whatever the case may be, still, the way that you examine your motivation and prepare yourself for practice is the same. If you are practicing for 1 hour or 2 hours or 3 hours or even just 20 or 30 minutes, the motivation, the way you set your motivation and the way you approach the practice should be the same, whatever the stuff or subject of the actual practice is. Sometimes your practice goes very well. You feel so good. You feel so happy. You think, oh, I did great. Your mind is just overjoyed. You think, I cultivated the motivation correctly. I nailed it in the actual practice. I dedicated perfectly at the end. That was awesome. Sometimes you think, I did such good practice. I practiced so well. I think I've almost reached the first Bodhisattva Bhumi. Sometimes you really get elated like that. You just think you nailed the practice absolutely. Maybe it's a sign your practice was supercharged, or maybe it was a sign that you slept really well. Who knows? In any case, however good the practice was, it's over. It was temporary. Don't get so worked up about it. Because when you practice, you might have these kinds of excited practice sessions, and then you might have practice sessions where everything goes terribly, and you end up really depressed and wanting to give up the whole thing. When you are practicing, you are going to have these kinds of experiences. Don't get too worked up about it. Don't get too excited about it. Our minds are prone to getting very excited when we have good experiences and very depressed and despairing when we have bad experiences. If you have a really wonderful practice session and you get all worked up about it and you think everything is going so well, inevitably later you're going to have a practice session that doesn't go so well. And if you think, oh, this is a sign that I've just failed completely, you might even want to give up the Dharma because your practice session went so terribly. That is not going to let the practice benefit you in any long-term way. We need to have more steadiness of mind than that. If our practice session goes well, our mind needs to be steady rather than excited. If our practice session seems to go very poorly, again, our mind needs to be more steady rather than despairing. If we have a really terrible practice session and we feel like we weren't able to do the practice at all, we should recognize it is through the force of our own negative karma that we were not able to practice and apply the methods properly. And we should supplicate the deity and the lama, particularly supplicate the root guru, for it is by their kindness that we are able to practice and continue practicing at all. And we should meditate on compassion for sentient beings and have faith in the objects of refuge. That's the appropriate response to having a really terrible practice session. And then you try again. When we practice well and feel elated, if we use that as a chance to increase our pride and think that we are such wonderful practitioners, then it's like a balloon blowing up. You can put however much water you want in the balloon, gallons and gallons of water in the balloon. It really doesn't mean anything. The balloon just gets bigger and bigger. It is not actually significant if our practice session goes wonderfully well or if our practice session goes horribly. When your practice session goes well, it makes you feel so good. When your practice session goes terribly, it makes you feel despairing, perhaps even to the point where you think, I might as well not even bother meditating. That was terrible. Or when your practice session goes well, you might think, oh, that felt so wonderful. I need to run around and tell everybody. No, you don't. You don't need to say a word to anybody. Actually, what the teachings say is that you should conceal your qualities and expose your faults. You don't need to run around and expose your qualities to everyone. People don't need to hear about it. It's just a display of your pride. Actually, if your practice session goes well, you think, this is the kindness of the three jewels and the ripening of my own merit. And you can rejoice, but your qualities you should conceal or hide. This is what it says in the teachings. Your faults, on the other hand, even the smallest fault, like this, as if it were the size of a needle, even the smallest fault you should reveal and confess and work to eradicate that fault. From the moment that you begin the practice, sometimes it goes well. Sometimes each stage seems to happen very easily. Sometimes it goes terribly, and you are not able to recall the meaning of the practice or maintain your mindfulness or anything. When your practice goes poorly, There is no reason to despair when you when your practice goes well. There's no reason to get excited. We would have a tendency when our practice goes well to think, oh, this meditation stuff is great. I'm going to definitely meditate again tomorrow. And when our practice goes poorly, we think, this meditation thing is terrible. I don't want to do that again. I'm not going to do my practice tomorrow. This is not going to allow us to practice in such a way that our practice will be profoundly transformative and really effective. When our practice goes poorly and we are left with a not so nice feeling at the end, we don't need to be depressed. We should recognize, of course, our practice is not always going to go well. We are sentient beings. We are wandering in samsara. We are buffeted by the waves of feeling good and feeling bad that are our karma. We are sometimes up. We are sometimes down. We sometimes get what we want. We sometimes don't get what we want. We sometimes like our experience. We sometimes don't like our experience. Either way, it is because of the karma that I accumulated in the past. That is why my practice seems to be going well or seems to not be going well. Either way, I still have the chance to follow a guru. I still have the chance to apply the teachings to my own mind. We should recognize that and in that way keep our minds steady and look forward to the next practice session as our next opportunity. If our practice goes poorly, then we think, may the next practice session go better, and supplicate the guru and supplicate the three jewels and meditate on compassion and try to fill our minds with faith. And then perhaps the next session will go better. Otherwise, we will always be taken up by waves of elation and brought low by being overwhelmed by despair. Now, it's very easy to talk about such things. And the concepts, these are not difficult concepts. It's easy to think about them, too. But to actually put this into practice, to have steadiness of mind, whether your practice is seemingly good or seemingly bad, it is so important. And it's not important because I say it's important. It's important because the enlightened intent of the victorious ones who have gone before have made much of this point. They have said it is so important to have steadiness of mind in your practice. And regarding faults and qualities, the appropriate way to relate to them is that you should conceal your qualities and reveal your faults. Revealing your faults to others and confessing them and purifying them or eliminating them, that is the practice of Dharma. To do the opposite, to make much of your qualities and conceal your faults, that is not the practice of Dharma. That's just a display of pride. When people say, oh no, I don't have any faults, they pretend not to have any faults, and they want to make much of all their qualities, that is not Dharma practice. That is just a display of pride. We should train our minds in this way again and again. We should bring familiarity through long habituation. And this is what's called lojong in Tibetan, or training the mind, refining one's mind. You refine your own mind. You train your own mind. You don't train someone else's mind. You just train your own mind. You train your mind in bodhicitta. We need to actually train our minds. And train means to do something repeatedly. It means to make our familiarity with something into a powerful habit. We should bring strong familiarity in the practice. That is what it means to train the mind. When we are training the mind in bodhicitta, we are bringing the mind onto the path of liberation. When we actually take the vow of bodhicitta, we generate bodhicitta, and we promise to train our minds in bodhicitta, to train our minds in the bodhisattva activities. And we promise to keep our minds on the path of liberation and complete omniscience. And we actually make this commitment. We swear that we will not deviate from the path to liberation and omniscience. So in order to actually keep that promise, we have to continuously be training our minds again and again, bringing the mind back to the path of liberation and omniscience. This is what mind training is. Mind training isn't something somebody can hand you. They can't give you a bag of mind training. They can't give you mind training like they would give you a meal or give you something to wear. Mind training is something that you have to do yourself. You have to train your own mind. Without any mind training, you are not going to be able to cultivate bodhicitta and maintain it. So each of us has to train our own minds. Some people think, we're not living in a time when we can really accomplish practice. We're not living in a time of practice. We're not living in a place conducive to practice. And in one way, there's a certain amount of truth to that. Here in Western countries, everyone is always busy. They are always busy in this very outer, engaged, always engaged way. As people living in India and Tibet in the past were not. The lifestyle is very different now. In many ways, is much busier and much faster. So there's a certain amount of truth to that. And people think, oh, because our lives in modern Western countries, because our lives are so busy, I don't have time to practice well. I'm not living in a country with conducive circumstances or in a time where the circumstances are right for me to be able to become a really good practitioner. Well, in one way, perhaps that's true. But what circumstances do you really need to be a good practitioner? What does it mean to be a really good practitioner? There are teachings on how one can attain Buddhahood without forsaking ordinary activity. Are there such teachings? Yes, there absolutely are such teachings. So what do such teachings actually look like? Essentially, such teachings show one how one can still train one's mind and one can still practice Dharma in a way that transforms one's mind and brings a realization, even if you are not able to abandon a hectic lifestyle, much engaged with the world, and simply go sit in solitary retreat somewhere. It is not necessary to sit in solitary retreat or sit in solitary meditation in order to achieve realization and Buddhahood itself. That is not the only correct way to practice. This means that there are ways to practice when one still has a job, when one is still working, when one is still going here and there, very much engaged with the world. For example, if you are someone working in a modern country, a modern city, you are working and you are constantly involved with people. You are always dependent on others. If you are working in a company, then you have a boss. You are working for your boss, and your boss is, you are relying on your boss to guide you. Your boss is relying on you to do work. They are overseeing you. You are serving them. There's a whole back and forth relationship. You are relying on each other. And if you are working for a company, then the people in that company are relying on other companies also. So you are relying on people all the time in your work, if you have a job, if you have any job. And because you are always relying on people and people are relying on you, there are always connections. There are always personal connections that you are making every day. All of those connections, all of that relying on other people, those are all opportunities to practice the bodhisattva trainings. When you are training as a bodhisattva in the six perfections, you can only train in the six perfections by relying on other sentient beings. That's how you practice. You practice the six perfections in relation to other beings, from generosity onward. When you are going about your daily work, your job, whatever it might be, if you are seeing it as your opportunity to engage in the six perfections, you are using that engagement in the world with other people in your ordinary work, you are using that as your opportunity to apply the bodhisattva trainings. If you have excellent motivation and you see the connections and relying upon others that comes as a natural part of your job, If you see that as the way you can practice the six perfections, then for you that is your training in the six perfections. And you will always be accomplishing your own benefit and the benefit of others by using all of your connections with others as your very way to train. And this is what our masters, our gurus, our spiritual mentors have taught, that this is a fully qualified way to practice. And you can actually see how this is of great benefit. If you have the boss of a company who is motivated in this way, trying to benefit both themselves and others in a meaningful way, and they are going about their job, they are doing their work with this excellent motivation, then they are going to be interacting with their employees and with other companies in this virtuous way. They are going to be creating virtue and eliminating negativity just in the way that they go about their business. Each of us has this opportunity. When we train in the Bodhisattva trainings, in the six perfections, it is only in our interactions with others that we can train. When we are working and going about our job in our daily life, we are always connecting with others. Therefore, we are always having the chance to train and rely on others in the training of the six perfections by our connection with them. We are always surrounded by opportunities to accomplish our own benefit and the benefit of others by accumulating merit and purifying negativity. It is not the case that the only way to attain enlightenment is to come and sit in one place with your eyes closed and your palms pressed together. That's not the only way to practice. That's not the only way to train your mind. You don't have to come to the temple particularly. You don't have to sit in a particular posture. You don't have to fold your hands at your heart and squeeze your eyes shut. You do not need those things in order to practice and in order to really train your mind. If you know how to practice at work, then every day that you go to your job, that is your opportunity for mind training. If you are not going to take your daily life as your opportunity to practice, then when are you ever going to have an opportunity to practice? People think, oh, I wasn't able to do much formal practice today, but I'll get to it next week. I'll get to it next year. Who knows when actually you're going to get to it? When you are still very much involved in your work and your daily life. But if you recognize that your daily life itself and your connections with other people can be the very doorway to the Bodhisattva trainings, then taking that as your opportunity to cultivate an excellent motivation and to have altruism, that is your opportunity to generate bodhicitta and put it into practice as the training in the six perfections, just as you are going about your work when you go to your job every day. Then that becomes your place of practice. So we should know that this idea of I'm living in the wrong country in the wrong time in order to do real practice. Well, in one way that's maybe true, but in one way that's not true. If we don't know how to really practice, then we won't ever have the opportunity to really practice. We will never tame our minds if we never actually get around to it. And we will certainly never find any opportunity to practice in any Western country or anywhere else for that matter. We need to know how to actually practice and what that actually means. So I think if everyone thinks on that a little bit, it will really be of benefit. We have encountered an extraordinary opportunity. And how is this? How did we get such a chance? Through the power of our merit, we have the extraordinary opportunity to practice the Dharma. And it is only because we have this remarkable human body that we have this opportunity to practice the Dharma. It is dependent on having a precious human birth, complete with the 18 conditions that allow for Dharma practice. It is only dependent on that, that we have this chance to practice. We need to recognize and appreciate any Dharma that we do, any quality that we are able to bring forth in our minds is only dependent upon this extraordinary circumstance, that we are able to cultivate faith in the three jewels or compassion for sentient beings, that we have been able to meet with a qualified lama and receive teachings on what we should adopt and what we should abandon in our own conduct, that we even know what the 10 virtues that we should take up and the 10 non-virtues that we should eliminate from our behavior are. All of these are only dependent on our having a human body, and not only that, but a precious human body that has allowed us to encounter the Dharma and study and practice. We really need to recognize and appreciate how extraordinary this chance is. And recognizing this opportunity, we will be very motivated not to waste it. For one who is not in the Dharma, who is not a Buddhist and does not know the Buddha's teachings, in general, there is a recognition that other sentient beings suffer. For example, if you see an animal dying, then you will think, oh, that being is suffering, and you might have compassion for it, even if you are not a Buddhist and you know nothing of the Buddha's teaching. But with the Buddha's teaching, you can understand that the suffering of the being who is dying is the result of their own karma ripening. As one who is not a Buddhist might recognize that other beings suffer, for example, when they die, and therefore they might think, oh, better that I don't kill other animals, or sorry, better that I don't kill other beings, such as animals, because they will suffer. They might recognize that. But they won't have the nuanced understanding, oh, I shouldn't kill another being, because if I do, I will make the cause for that same suffering for myself in the future. They won't understand the subtleties of the law of cause and result. That only comes about through having heard the Buddha's teaching and having understood something of the Dharma. That only comes about through having had this chance of a precious human birth that has allowed you to encounter the Dharma, receive teachings, and then think about them. Otherwise, you wouldn't have such understanding of karma, even that simplest understanding of karma on the grossest level. If you consider how many years it has been since you first entered the path of Dharma and became a Buddhist until now, most of you have done one Ngundro or are doing the Ngundro practices. And at the beginning, you do the common preliminaries, the outer preliminaries, which are the four thoughts that turn the mind to Dharma. And then you do the uncommon or inner preliminaries, beginning with refuge and bodhicitta and so forth. When you begin the Ngundro, so at the beginning of the beginning practices, at the beginning of the preliminary practices, you start with this, the contemplation of the rarity and preciousness of the human birth. The first of the common outer preliminaries, the first of the four thoughts that turn the mind to Dharma, is this, the contemplation on how difficult it is to get a human birth, and not only a human birth, but a precious human birth. In the teachings on how to enhance your understanding of how rare a human birth is, there are generally three ways that you can drive the point home to yourself that to have a human birth is extremely rare. What you have your hands on now with a human birth is extraordinarily rare, extraordinarily scarce in the greater scope of all existence, of all samsara. And generally this is explained in three ways. Showing how rare the human birth is based on its causes, based on examples or illustrative analogies, and based on numbers. When we consider the causes of human birth is extremely rare because you have to assemble just the right causes in order to be born into a human body. Particularly, you must have created some powerful karma through the practice and holding of discipline. And you have to have accumulated great merit and purified tremendous negativity and trained in discipline, these three together. And based on that, when the circumstances are just so, you will be able to attain a human body. And not only a human body, but in very exceptional cases, a precious human body, complete with the 18 circumstances that allow you to practice the Dharma. You don't just come upon a human body through luck. It doesn't work that way. You have to have all the causes, the conditions have to be just right, or you won't get a human body. So you can consider how rare a human body is based on how difficult it is to assemble just the right causes and just the right conditions so that you can actually get yourself a human body. So that's the first way that you can consider that the human body is rare and difficult to obtain. And the second is using examples or illustrations. And the most famous of which is the idea that a turtle out in the ocean that surfaces only once every 100 years is more likely to put their head up through the center of a yolk floating upon the ocean, then that is more likely to happen and happens more frequently than a being attains a precious human body. So many examples are given, but this is just the most famous one. But the point, again, is to make a picture in your mind of just how rare and how extraordinary getting a human body actually is. And the third way we consider the rarity of a human birth is to consider the numbers. When you think of the numbers of how many beings there are in samsara versus how many human beings there are remarkably many beings in all the other realms and remarkably few humans. And among human beings, if you think of beings who do not have a precious human birth, but just have an ordinary human birth, there are a great many more beings who have not encountered the Dharma and have a precious human birth than who do. If you consider even just the animals that we are able to perceive, I think maybe one anthill has as many ants in it as there are people on all the earth. And so think then how many ants there are in all the world. There are so few humans compared to the number of animals there are just living on this, living in this world with us. You can consider the numbers. How many animals? How many humans? There's not that many humans. To get a human birth, to get a human body, just by looking at the numbers, is extremely rare. And among humans, to have a body in which you have encountered the Dharma and have interest in practice, and all the conditions are just right, that you can actually study and apply the Dharma to your mind, that is extremely rare, extremely, extremely rare, to actually have the circumstances where you can apply your mind to generating faith and compassion for sentient beings. That is rare beyond rare. The example is given that sentient beings are like stars at nighttime. Human beings are as rare as stars in the daytime. And if human beings were as numerous as stars at night, those who can practice Dharma, who have that opportunity or who have a precious human birth, are as rare as stars in the daytime. So when we consider the numbers, too, we should recognize and appreciate how what we have with a precious human birth is something extraordinary, something extremely rare. We have our opportunity. We have our chance. The more we recognize how precious this opportunity is, the opportunity of just having a human body itself, the more we will value it and the more afraid we will be to lose it without using it to the best possible, without putting it to the best possible use. Recognizing this, we should have some confidence. We should be roused to want to use our chance. We should be motivated or galvanized to take our opportunity. Seeing how precious this opportunity is, we should be filled with this urgency to use it while we have it. We have a human birth. We have a human body. We have met lamas. We have had the chance to encounter the Dharma. We can apply that to our own minds. We need to do that. We need to use our human body before it's too late. We should be motivated to practice in this very urgent way. That should be the basis for the mind training. Recognizing the preciousness of our opportunity, recognizing how extraordinary the chance that we have is, and thinking, I must make use of it. I must not let it go to waste. Considering our extraordinary opportunity, our extraordinary chance in this way, we will be filled with this determination. I have a precious human birth. I should put it to the best possible use. I have this extraordinary opportunity. I shouldn't waste it. I do want to practice, and I want to practice Dharma purely. I want to practice correctly. If we consider how it is only by virtue of having a human body itself that we have the opportunity to practice, we will be filled with this desire to practice for as long as we can still rely on this human form. Because if we're in the three lower realms, we won't have any chance to practice. Hell beings, hungry ghosts, animals, they don't get to practice. They don't encounter the Dharma. The gods and the jealous gods, if you're born there, you don't get any Dharma. You don't get any practice. There is no word of Dharma in those realms. No beings in those realms have any chance to understand the Dharma. They don't encounter any Dharma. They have no chance to study the Dharma or practice the Dharma, to try to mingle their minds with the meaning of Dharma. None of that. They are in situations completely desolate in terms of Dharma. Ourselves, we are in a situation rich with the chance to practice Dharma. And recognizing this is my situation, appreciating I do have this chance, seeing I have the extraordinary opportunity to practice. And this opportunity is not easy to come by. By looking at its causes, by looking at examples, by looking at the sheer numbers of the beings in existence who have this opportunity, there are not many. It is very difficult to get. I have it. I've got it. When we recognize that, we will be motivated to practice, and to practice very sincerely in a heartfelt way. Recognizing that this opportunity is so rare and so precious, we should then move on to the second of the four thoughts that turn the mind to Dharma, and know that this opportunity is not going to last. This life is impermanent, and death is assured. This life is impermanent and our death is certain. We should contemplate this until certainty about it fills our mind. It doesn't take elaborate rational investigation to determine this for ourselves. Just look around. We have so many ways that we can prove to ourselves that all things are impermanent. Of course, we ourselves fall into that category too. If you look at the inanimate universe, the universe itself, it's impermanent. It does not last forever. If you look at all the inhabitants of that universe, all the sentient beings, they are impermanent. They do not last forever. And even the greatest beings and enlightened masters who have ever been born, who have ever come into being, they all have been impermanent and are no longer with us. There are many different ways that you can take yourself through the contemplation on the truth of death and impermanence in order to convince yourself that it is true, that all things of this world are impermanent, and that you yourself will die. But very simply, we can prove it to ourselves by looking in three different directions. We can look at the outer universe, the inanimate universe, the sentient beings who inhabit it, and particularly the great masters or enlightened masters of the past. And examining all three of these, the universe, its inhabitants, and great masters of the past, we can see there is no phenomena in those three categories that is permanent. There is no phenomena in those three categories that is permanent. All of those phenomena, all of those beings are impermanent. All of those beings die sooner or later. We ourselves are impermanent phenomena. We ourselves are going to die. And this life that seems to us so solid and well established at the moment is actually no more well established, no more stable or reliable than a candle left outside in the wind. Normally you leave a candle inside the house where the wind can't get at it, right? Because if you put a candle outside the house, any second a gust of wind, any stray breeze can put it out. Our life is like that, not like a candle kept inside, but a candle left outside. Any moment, any stray breeze could put it out. That's what we need to think when we consider this precious human birth that we have. As we have been born, we are bound to die. And if we look around, we can see our chances for death are very high. We are surrounded by all of the things that could easily lead to the circumstances of our death. We are surrounded by things that could easily become the very things that cause our death. And really, there's only a very few things that are helping to support and sustain our life. We can be killed really at any moment by illness, by some kind of weapon, by poison, by the four elements themselves, by fire, by wind, by water, by the earth itself. How many different ways are there to die, and to die at any moment? Whereas the things that we need to sustain our life, there are not so many of those, and they are not so easy to come by. We need food, and we need clothes, and we need shelter, and we need medicine, and so on and so forth. There's not that much in this world that we can rely upon to help extend our life. And there are many, many circumstances, many, many substances, many, many factors that could instantly bring about our death. If we consider that, we will see it is completely uncertain when the time of our death is going to be. If we look outside, we can see that there is nothing in the external universe that is solid or permanent, nothing that is reliable, nothing that will last forever. If we look at the sentient beings who inhabit it, all the inhabitants of the universe, every being that we can think of, that being will also die. We are not in some other category. We are going to die too. If we consider any being, even if we just consider the people gathered here now in the temple, there's maybe 40 or 50 or 60 people. And you might think, oh, they're all different ages, and therefore some of them are closer to death and some of them are further from death. There is no guarantee of that. The sun rises, and as soon as it rises, it begins to travel west. And very quickly, it reaches its height, and then it begins to go down. And for us, none of us know where our sun is. We don't know if we have a long time before it sets or if it is already well on its way down. We don't know if we have a few minutes or hours or days or years. We absolutely don't know. And this is why we can't put off practice, because we have no guarantee that there's going to be a later that we'll have the chance to practice in. If we think, I'll practice later, can you guarantee that you're going to be around later to practice? If you say, oh, I'll practice tomorrow, I'll practice next week, next month, next year, what guarantee do you have that you'll be around next year to do your practice then? Who knows when they are going to die? Who knows when this opportunity for practice, this human birth, is going to come to an end? And that is why if you ask when you should practice, you need to practice now. When is the time to practice? The time to practice is now. Or else it is not going to happen. We have no guarantee that we will have some future opportunity. We can recognize through the contemplation on the precious human birth that we have the opportunity now at this moment. It means that we need to take that opportunity now while we have it. If we do practice now, who is going to receive the benefit? We ourselves will receive the benefit. If we practice, should we practice only for this life? We've just gone through the contemplation of the fact that this life is impermanent and could end at any moment. Therefore, what is the point in practicing in order to bring benefit in this life that could end at any time? If we practice and focus only on getting some benefit in this life, we will certainly not attain Buddhahood. We will certainly not even attain the stages and paths approaching Buddhahood. So the scope of our motivation and intention needs to be beyond just this life. If we practice sincerely, not just for this life, but we practice for the greater purpose of being free from samsara and attaining Buddhahood, maybe in this life we won't reach Buddhahood itself, but we will create the causes of being able to continue practicing in the future. If we practice with the excellent motivation of wanting to free ourselves and others from suffering and attain perfect Buddhahood, Even if we don't reach our ultimate goal in the course of this life, we will make the causes for being able to again meet with a spiritual mentor in the future, again being able to encounter the Dharma, again being able to practice, again being able to purify our negativity and accumulate merit, so that eventually we will achieve the ultimate state. That is how we should practice and why we should practice. If you know that you're going to go far away, you need to prepare. You need to prepare food, or you need to bring the right kind and amount of money so that you can pay for your food, lodging, or whatever the case may be. You need to think ahead and plan. If you just go empty-handed and without any preparation, you're going to have a really rough time of it. You're not going to have a good trip. And yeah, sure, even if you don't bring any supplies, you could maybe steal some along the way, or you might be able to figure something out, you might be able to beg from somebody, but it's going to be difficult. And you're probably going to accumulate a lot of non-virtue trying to wrangle that in the last minute if you didn't prepare properly. We right now have a precious human birth. If we fail to practice the Dharma, it is like not preparing to go on the long trip of the bardo. If you enter the bardo empty-handed, I gotta tell you, you won't even be able to beg, borrow, or steal any merit once you're there. When you're going on the trip to the bardo, you need to bring something with you. You don't want to go empty-handed. Everyone is afraid of death. Why? Because we don't know what comes after. We don't know where we're going to go. But we have this sense that we're going empty-handed and that we're not properly prepared. If you live a life of virtue and you really try to practice sincerely, you will have this sense of confidence regarding your death. You will think, I'm not going into the bardo empty-handed. You will think, I have a little merit to take along with me. And you will have some confidence, and that will be very good. You will not have to fear death. You will not have to be terrified at the prospect of death, because you will know that you have something to take with you. That is really to be practicing Dharma in a meaningful way and for the right reasons. That is how we should practice. That is why we should practice. If we're just practicing hoping for some kind of success or renown in this life, that's not Dharma. That's not knowing how to use the Dharma. That's not knowing how to really seize the opportunity of this precious human birth. This life is not permanent. This life is going to come to an end. We will enter the bardo, and therefore we need to bring something with us, because we don't, any of us, want to go into the bardo empty-handed. So right now, when we have the chance to gather a little something to take with us to the bardo, we need to do just that. We need to practice. We have the chance, we have the opportunity, we have the capacity. We need to not waste them. We need to practice, and we need to practice sincerely and wholeheartedly. If we really internalize the truth of impermanence, that all things in this world are impermanent and we ourselves are bound to die, being impermanent phenomena also, our minds will no longer be distracted by other thoughts. We will not be drawn away from the Dharma. We will not be drawn away from our practice. We will not be taken in by any of samsara's enticements. If we really understand impermanence, we will know we're not going to live a long time. Even if we live what seems to be a long human life, our death is fast approaching, even in the best case scenario. And knowing that, we will not place great importance on the things of this life, but instead, knowing that this life could end at any time, and even in the best case scenario, very soon, we will only think of the bigger picture. We will always hold a greater perspective. We will consider what's going to be of use to me in the bardo and in future lives. That is what will become important to you. Your priorities will naturally rearrange themselves when your mind is filled with the truth of impermanence. And you will always turn your mind naturally to what's going to be of benefit to you in the bardo and in future lives. And you will no longer look to the phenomena of this life for your satisfaction, your happiness, or your contentment. You don't need to engage in a great many other practices in order to bring your mind to this state. You just need to really consider carefully the truth of impermanence. As mentioned before, even all the great masters, even the enlightened beings of the past, have proved to be impermanent. Look at Buddha Shakyamuni himself, the original teacher of our era, he whose body displayed the 32 major and 80 minor marks of enlightenment. He came to the land of India 2,500 years ago, and he is no longer here with us. He couldn't stay. He, too, was proved to be impermanent. If even Buddha Shakyamuni, with his body perfect, with the 32 major and 80 minor marks of his perfected realization, if even he could not stay forever in his body, we should recognize we ourselves are certainly not going to stay long in ours. Recognizing that all of the great masters of the past have passed away in this same way, we should prove to ourselves again and again, we are not going to stay long in this realm. Even in the best possible case, we are not going to be here for long. Look at Padmasambhava. He attained the state of great transference rainbow body. He didn't even stay in Tibet. He departed to the southwest land of the Rakshasas in order to continue his enlightened activity there. Look at his 25 disciples, these great enlightened masters. Look at the greatest masters of India and Tibet. Look at Longchenpa or Jingme Lingpa or Mipham Rinpoche. How many lamas, how many realized masters, how many fully enlightened beings have come, have manifested in so many different forms. And we don't have the opportunity to see them in the flesh still. We hear their names, we know what they were called, but we can't meet them. Why? Because those forms were impermanent. We ourselves are certainly impermanent, then. This is the conclusion that we should draw when we are considering such things. We ourselves are certainly impermanent. And as we are certainly impermanent, we are certainly going to be catapulted into the bardo, and we certainly need something to take with us. Our lives really are like candles left outside. We have no idea when that stray gust of wind is going to put it out. Therefore, we must practice, and we must practice now. If you say, I don't have time to contemplate impermanence because I am too busy, well, if you contemplate impermanence, you will realize that all the things of this life that are keeping you so busy don't have any real meaning, don't have any real substance, don't have any real significance in the long run. In the greater perspective, all that keeps us so busy that we can't possibly practice in this life, all of that loses its significance in light of the fact that this life itself is impermanent. Yes, in this life, we do need to work because we do need to eat. We do need something to drink and something to wear. But really, we need to focus on cultivating contentment. How many people actually feel that what they have is enough? Have you met even one or two who really honestly say, oh, I have enough? Everyone always wants more. We want more and more and more. We will never find satisfaction through wanting more and thinking that getting more is going to bring satisfaction. We just have to cultivate satisfaction. That's the only way we will ever have satisfaction. If we want to accomplish the Dharma, we need to cultivate a sense of satisfaction, a sense of contentment, a sense that what we have is enough. Let's say you are faced with a choice. You could become the sole possessor of all the wealth in all the world, or you could practice Dharma. And either way, you are going to die tomorrow. Now, if you are a Buddhist and you know a little something about karma, you would want to spend your day in practice. And all the wealth in the world would hold no attraction for you, because you would know that what you really need when you die tomorrow is not all the wealth in the world. It's not going to do you any good. But if you spend the day in practice, let's say you spend the day reciting mani mantras, that's going to give you a little something to put in your purse and take into the bardo with you. At the time of your death, all the money in the world is going to mean nothing. It's not going to benefit you one bit as you enter the bardo. But whatever dharma you have been able to practice, that will be of benefit to you. Nothing in this world is going to benefit you in the bardo or in future lives. In fact, most of the things of this world are going to bring you harm through their pursuit. You will most likely create negative karma that ultimately brings you harm. Most of the things of this world, most of the concerns of this life alone, most of them bring you no benefit. Most of them only bring you harm through the creation of negative karma. If we are considering temporary and ultimate happiness,